Welcome to Pop Pantheon, the podcast where we completely overanalyze all of your favorite pop stars and then rank them in the official Pop Pantheon. This is your host, DJ Louis XIV, reminding you to please rate, review, and subscribe to Pop Pantheon wherever you're listening to it right now. I'm on social media at DJ LOUIEXIV. The podcast is at Pop Pantheon Pod. And we have merch available at poppantheonpod.com. And our Patreon channel, Pop Pantheon All Access, is available at patreon.com/poppantheon or by subscribing directly in Apple Podcasts. This week, we were discussing Kacey Musgraves' fantastic new album, Deeper Well. We have weekly bonus episodes there, plus a ton of other perks. Again, that's at patreon.com/poppantheon. Also, our upcoming live show in New York City is sold out on April 22nd, but our dance party, Taylor Mania, still has some tickets available. That will be on Friday, April 19th at Parkside Lounge on the Lower East Side. You can buy tickets for that in the show notes of this episode. The following night will be Gorgeous Gorgeous in Los Angeles at Los Globos in Silver Lake. So parties on both coasts on consecutive nights. It's going to be a crazy weekend. And yeah, so I hope to see you guys at some of those upcoming parties. Links for tickets to all of that is in the show notes of this episode. Last bit of housekeeping. We are still accepting mailbag questions for our upcoming mailbag episode. So if you have any questions about pop music, about the show, about the Pop Pantheon, about pop stars, really anything you want us to answer, you can send them to poppantheonpod@gmail.com. We prefer voice notes so we can play your lovely voices on air, but we will also be accepting written questions. So send in your mailbag questions ASAP. All right, so for this week's B-side, I know I don't have to remind anybody that's listening to this show that Beyoncé's new record, Cowboy Carter, the second of her new trilogy, is out tonight. Pretty exciting. And this is Beyoncé's supposed pivot into country music, as far as we can tell. So I wanted to get a little bit deeper in the context of what it means for Beyoncé to be releasing country music as a Black woman, as a pop diva who is entering the country space more explicitly, or as we'll find out in this episode, maybe she's always been there. And as we know, Beyoncé's music always begs to be read into very deeply. I invited Taylor Crumpton and Dr. Francesca Royster onto the show. They are experts in this field, the field of the Black history of country music, to give us some insight into exactly why it's meaningful that Beyoncé is releasing this country record, Cowboy Carter, and to help us all contextualize this moment. If you're interested in hearing my thoughts on Cowboy Carter, we will be discussing the album in depth on our Patreon episode next week. So without further ado, here is my conversation about Cowboy Carter and the history of Black country music with Dr. Francesca Royster and Taylor Crumpton. All right, so I am here with DePaul University professor and author of Black Country Music, Listening for Revolutions, Dr. Francesca Royster. Dr. Royster, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thank you. It was so great to be here.
So thrilled to have you. And I'm also here with writer and editor and author of the timepiece, Beyoncé Has Always Been Country, Taylor Crumpton. Taylor, welcome to the show.
I'm so excited to be on here with y'all.
I'm so thrilled to have this conversation with both of you and really to learn from both of you. I'm not a particularly well-versed country connoisseur, and I've learned so much from reading both of your work, and I'm very excited because I am a Beyoncé connoisseur. That is something that I do know very well. That is an area of academic study that I can actually lay claim to. So maybe that can be some of my contribution to the conversation. But as we all know, or as I think everyone that's listening to this show knows, Beyoncé is on the verge of releasing her new studio album. It appears to be the second in a trilogy of albums, and we haven't heard it yet, but the general vibe around it seems to be that Beyoncé is in her country music era, that Beyoncé is essentially making a genre experiment in country music. And this is beyond just a lark for her as a genre exercise. There's obviously a deeper historical context to what's going on here. And I will say that was true of the first part of this trilogy. So that seems to be a bit of a theme here, is that Beyoncé seems to be using this trilogy to potentially reclaim genres of music that have been white-facing or have been perceived as white-facing in recent times, but have roots historically with Black folks and as Black musical traditions, you know, dance music and now country music. So that's the context that we're here in. And I invited you both here because I want to learn a little bit about that context. And I want our listeners, who I also know are very excited to hear this record, but might not know some of this history, to help maybe understand a little bit more about what is driving Beyoncé to do this work. work, and also what, even without her intentions involved, like what is the context into which Cowboy Carter is arriving? So I guess to start us off, maybe Taylor, I'll ask you this question. What were your initial reactions to Beyoncé's move into country? And once we heard the first couple singles from this record about a month ago, which were Texas Hold'em and 16 Carriages, what did that indicate to you about how she's viewing herself as a country practitioner in this era?
For years, I have told my friends that Act Two is going to be a country album, because since Black is King, and even if we have to predate that from self-titled, she's been playing with themes of home identity and what it means to mature into them over time. And I know we often joke about inner child work and that regaining touch with a version of yourself that you couldn't have been at that time. And I feel that when Beyoncé speaks about country music and country identity, and that being something through her mother's lineage, something through her father's lineage. So I think selfishly, and also being a critic, I was like, I can't wait to see how she addresses that. And we got her being a child of the African diaspora in Black is King, but we're seeing her retouch with her childhood self, a little Black girl from Texas, on Texas Hold'em and 16 Carriages. So it feels like a beautiful full circle moment, not only for her as a Black woman in music. I think she had to become the world's greatest entertainer of all time just to re-enter the country music space. And I feel that's something we may touch on at a different time about like the reception to her. But when I heard Texas Hold'em and 16 Carriages, I mean, I cried, I screamed, I yelled. I mean, all the things you do when you're line dancing, to be quite honest, is a very emotional experience. But I think for those who have always felt this connection and this tie, but had been made fun of for it or ostracized or felt that we couldn't claim it, it felt as if she was welcoming back into the dance hall that is our home, which is country music.
Very interesting too. When she announced her album cover this afternoon, she wrote like a long Instagram caption about how a lot of this seems to have arisen from the fact that, as we know, on Lemonade, she had a song called Daddy Lessons that was her most explicit country referencing song to this recent point. And she famously performed it at, I believe it was the CMAs, with the Dixie Chicks, who were also famously ostracized from country music when they criticized President George W. Bush in the wake of the Iraq and Afghanistan wars. He held me in his arms, and he taught me to be strong. He told me when he's gone, here's what to do. And she laid out, kind of more so than she ever does, I mean, she's not particularly transparent often, you know, with what she's doing. She really lets her work speak for itself for the most part. But it was notable to me that when she posted this caption, it was apparently a very eye-opening experience to her, because she seemed to feel that she wasn't welcomed by that community during that performance, and that a lot of her impulse to explore this genre and to explore this with the level of historical and academia mindedness that Beyoncé brings to most endeavors that she attempts came from the fact that it opened her own eyes in a way maybe that she didn't even totally see before to the ways that women like her or people that look like her had been ostracized from this community or were inherently seen as outsiders in this community. So I thought that that was very interesting, that like in some ways for Beyoncé on her own personal journey, that this was like kind of a response to this thing that happened to them. I think a lot of people spoke about, but we hadn't heard her actually like address in that time. Dr. Royster, I'm curious if you could help us understand, like, in terms of Texas Hold'em and 16 Carriages, are there particular like country subgenres or historical moments that those songs are referencing? Like, obviously country is like an incredibly broad term. I was wondering if when you heard either of these songs, were there specific moments in country history or certain genres or movements in country that these songs felt like they were explicitly making reference to?
Sure, and please call me Francesca.
Oh, okay.
I appreciate that. But yeah, when I heard this music, I definitely had Renaissance One in my ears. And so I was really thinking about this idea of a continuous connection, as I really like the way that you put that, Taylor, that country music is our dance hall. And when I heard Texas Hold'em and then also heard Rhiannon Giddens playing the banjo on it, I thought, okay, this is great, because she's really getting us to think about dance music as a kind of sacred healing music, and to have Rhiannon Giddens uses a model of a minstrel banjo for her performances. And she's really looking backwards to a kind of reclaiming of older string band and even minstrel blackface traditions, where black artists were the teachers and white performers were the apprentices. But also before that, the ways that enslaved black people used the banjo as the instrument of dance, of healing, of ritual, as well as, you know, entertaining their masters. So already in Texas Hold'em, I was thinking about that historic piece and the kind of joy that the song is embracing, the joy and sensuality and sex together with this kind of sacred instrument, or instrument that was once thought of as sacred and kind of has gone through a really difficult, bloody history. I was absolutely thinking about that. This ain't Texas. Ain't no Hold'em. I was thinking, okay, so she's inviting her queer, femme-identified friends into the dive bar, and we are having a dance. And, you know, there's never any pronouns, I don't think, in that song, you know, so we don't know exactly who the partners are. There's a kind of, to me, I really heard a kind of gender-open invitation that she was making with Texas Hold'em. So very much joyful, very much to me in conversation, of course, with Daddy Lessons, but also with Renaissance too, and with 16 Carriages, you know, hearing Robert Randolph's slide pedal steel guitar there, I really thought about traditions of the sacred and the ways that, whether we're talking about Sacred Steel's use of the pedal guitar for gospel, or even thinking about mainstream country music artists who are using country in connection or conversation with gospel. That to me was an important background that I heard. I was thinking about, you know, people like Jim Reeves or even Johnny Cash on that song, and the iconography of traveling the long road. But she's using those kinds of stories and images to also talk about the work and labor, her own kind of journey as an artist from Destiny's Child to current day, to making this album, which apparently she's put years into. I might cook clean, but still won't fall. Still working all my life, you know. Only God knows, only God knows, only God knows. 16 carriages driving away while I watch them ride with my fears away to the summer sunset on a holy night on a long back road. All the tears I fight. So I just thought it was really interesting to kind of think about and kind of claim that space of a kind of spiritual quest on 16 Carriages while also linking it to our own autobiography, and that tradition of linking the self and the construction of the self to larger notions of a journey are so much a part of country music and country music storytelling. And I actually also just wanted to bring up the work of Linda Martell, who also was telling stories that were sometimes autobiographical and sometimes really had special poignance for her Black listeners, even while using a kind of country-politan, pop country sound to her music in Color Me Country. So she was definitely also someone I was thinking of when I heard those songs. I think I'll color him father. I think I'll color him love. But in the immediate moment, I was just like, it's here. It's finally here. Because I'd also been waiting, you know? So
yes. The rumor mill had swirled. I love what both of you said. And the only thing that I wanted to add is how well I thought both of these songs, if you even strip away the genre context, like fit into the broader project of like what Beyoncé has been doing. I think especially in the last 10 plus years since her self-titled visual album came out in 2013, which is like two main prongs of it, each of these songs respectively hit. Obviously with Texas Hold'em, she's continuing the long tradition of Beyoncé as mother of the dance floor, of, you know, queen of our collective revelry that's been going on since Destiny's Child and has threaded through her entire career and is just recontextualized here, but fits in many ways into something that Beyoncé has done for so long. And I love your point about the pronouns. The only quote-unquote pronoun I think she uses is bitch in the affirmative way, in the sort of queer slang sort of way, which I really appreciate because that gives it a very particular Beyoncé flavor. Like when she said that, I was like, oh, there's Beyoncé. That line could have been on Renaissance and any of those other songs as well. And then the other one, as you were sort of mentioning, Francesca, about the sort of storytelling aspect of 16 Carriages, Beyoncé using her own mythos and her own storytelling about her life as a way of like connecting to broader stories of Black identity and also to just broadly human experience has been such a huge part of her career all throughout, really, but really particularly, I think, since that self-titled album, of course, with Lemonade. There was this prong of Beyoncé's artistry that I think has revealed in some ways like one of the most profound aspects of what she does, which is the way that she's able to like use her own story and then her sort of academic approach to history to connect her struggle to humanity's struggle. And I thought that this song, 16 Carriages, really like fits very nicely into that as part of a broader lineage in Beyoncé's discography. So both of these songs felt a new spin genre-wise. Like, we haven't, besides Daddy Lessons, we haven't really heard Beyoncé make explicitly country music before, I don't think, or maybe you guys will correct me on that as we go on. But it was interesting also the way that it still felt like it was on continuums with other parts of Beyoncé's work. And I know, Taylor, that's something that you explore in your piece as well, just Beyoncé as fundamentally country in many ways, even if it's not so much of like an explicit genre thing. I wonder if you guys could also help us understand the reaction to this music, because obviously even before we heard the reaction, it was almost like everybody was anticipating the reaction, because Nashville establishment as it stands right now is such a almost cliched in its adverseness to outsiderdom, or what it perceives as outsiderdom. So yes. Taylor, perhaps you could help to sort of characterize what actually did happen once Beyoncé took this step, released these songs, as it pertains to radio programmers, country music institutions, and maybe more traditional country fans. And we could talk about Beyoncé fans too, but I think more interesting what the country establishment did in reaction to this.
You know, I feel like a broken record, literally, when I bring up the Oklahoma music radio station refusing to play Beyoncé and telling the Beehive listener who emailed to request the song, we do not play Beyoncé because she's an R&B artist, right? And that is so telling when we think about the rhetoric of R&B, which in that moment was racially coded as Black. And we know that for Black country artists, they get the least amount of airplay on country music radio. And that is so impactful to their careers, because it's one of the few spaces in the music industry where radio is king. Radio is essential to the development of an artist. All the other genres, I want to bring hip hop to the conversation, right? Because hip hop and TikTok have become hand in hand with each other, which started off as a Black genre, but arguably right now is the most multiracial genre we have out there. Anyone from TikTok can chart on the Billboard hip hop charts and then maybe gain legitimacy through a BET award or a hip hop award, right? Black genres are more welcoming of people of different races and genders to participate in our cultural productions versus country music, which has aligned itself not only with the migration of white conservatives from DC to Nashville, right, to even redo the cultural identity of Nashville, right, but has overtly allowed the GOP, white conservatism, fascism, white supremacy to infiltrate, right? So when you're hearing these no's and these refutes and these rebukes, it is also racially coded, but also politically coded. I cannot allow someone who is Beyoncé, who has been so vocal in supporting Black Lives Matter and even Renaissance, making a welcoming queer space, right? Right now, when we're seeing so much anti-queer and anti-trans legislation, the rebuke was firm. The rebuke was a no. But Beyoncé and the Beehive, if I have to quote Whitney Houston, said, hell no, we are knocking this shit down, okay? you will let us in. And I think that that advocacy, right, it allowed so many Black women in country music, Kay Michelle, Tanner Adley, Reese Palmer, who is one of the seven Black women to chart on Billboard, to get these streams and these revenues and to show country, though you may have tried many times to tell me no, because this has happened, right? Because this has occurred, now there's a chance for a brighter, Blacker future in country music. But on the flip side, there are some who, even as today, as we are recording this, who saw Beyoncé's album cover for Act Two holding the American flag, questioned Beyoncé's Blackness, right? Questioned why this Black woman would be holding this American flag on the horse. course. So there is appreciation for her. There is also a firm critique of her of why she is doing this. And right now, when we know conditions for Black people in America are so destructive, but if I can be personal for a second, that's what it means to be a Black woman from Texas. It means to appreciate the cultural productions of your lineage, of your heritage, but also having a firm rebuke of those who have tried to keep you out. I mean, the Houston Rodeo is a big Black space, but also historically has been an anti-Black space. But you have Bun B come and bring Erykah Badu, bring Scarface, bring all this Blackness right to it. And that is what Beyoncé is doing right now. She is telling you, though you may keep me out, this is mine. And I will, if I can be frank, because I am from the South, I will knock you the fuck out and make sure that you never allow this to happen to anyone again. Forgive me for cussing. I'm from the South, so we cuss.
Oh, please,
and then we
go
praise
on.
God, and then we cuss, and we praise God.
This is a safe space for both of those. Whatever works for you is good with us. Francesca, I'd love if you have anything to add to that about the reaction to this, but I just wanted to jump in and say, I feel like Beyoncé knew how this was going to go down on some level. I mean, she's no fool. She knew exactly what this was all going to land like for various sectors of American popular culture. And I feel like that's very intentional on her part. I think creating these moments where she's highlighting how racist, sexist, etc., these spaces can be and have been and are for artists right now that are working in the space but like can't garner the attention that Beyoncé can with every single thing that she does. I feel like that's a huge intention, perhaps beyond just her artistic intentions with this. That's part of the sort of idea behind this project, is to sort of provoke those reactions and thus to bring them to light. Does that make sense? And also, Francesca, if there's anything you want to add about the reactions, I'd love to hear that as well.
Oh, yeah, definitely. I mean, I just want to add that this is her work is supported and upheld by all the history of activist country music making that's been happening, kind of led by Black women with also some really key figures, Black men as well. But that we were really in a moment that Daddy Lessons was a part of, Lil Nas X's Old Town Road pushing, Luke Combs's cover of Fast Car, but maybe even more significantly, Tracy Chapman winning the CMA Song of the Year Songwriter Award, and then that amazing performance between them on the Grammys, that we're at a point of public reckoning, but maybe more than reckoning, just kind of speeding up the process of reckoning and kind of taking the reins.
I remember when we were driving in your car, speed so fast it felt like I was gone, city lights lay out before.
I always think about the importance of the horse, you know, in the cover as well as in Renaissance. Like, this is also like an evocation of an almost like superhuman kind of force that's necessary to create social change. There's a kind of work that's necessary, but also kind of mythological power that, of course, Beyoncé is so good at evoking.
Yes, for sure. All right. So I guess I want to help pull back a little bit and get a little bit more into like the context and history of this, and maybe just like the broader culture that all of this is arriving into. Perhaps, Taylor, could you talk, because you were just talking about your status as a proud Southern person, and I think that this is really important for all of the coastal dwellers that are probably listening to this podcast right now. Can you just characterize for people that are not inside of the country universe? Because one of the funniest parts about country is that it is one of the most thriving genres of music in America, but it feels at the same time kind of like it exists, and no pun intended, but in like a bit of a segregated space and a bit of a place that is sort of separate from the rest of American popular music. As you mentioned, like Nashville's kind of its own ecosystem. It has rules that are somehow different than other popular music rules. It operates under different auspices. Radio is still more important in a way that it's not for other genres. And you can have big superstars and big movements happening over in that world that just do not ever enter the like consciousness of the average other pop sphere listenership. So, Taylor, can you just like help us understand a little bit about like how country music is consumed in the places where it is consumed, and particularly for Black folks, for Mexican folks, for like non-white people, like how is that music, given how like white facing it appears at the moment, even though obviously we know it's not actually, what is like the fandom of country music like currently in the spaces where it's beloved?
No, we grow up with country music in Texas. Even Texas itself, it was a Mexican province, which was actually indigenous land, right? Their name Texas is a Spanish spelling of a Caddo word, which means friend, right? So when you talk about Texas, inherently and subconsciously, you're talking about Mexico, you're talking about our indigenous community in Texas. When white Southerners came in, they brought enslaved Africans, and we made up 25% of the state population, right? So we've always been in a unique cultural exchange that isn't felt throughout other states in the Deep South. We've always had to share space with each other. We've always been in exchange with each other. And when we think about the cowboy, right, 1 in 4 cowboys were African-American, but also a significant amount were Mexican-American and indigenous. So we're building this ecosystem. We're building this economy, this infrastructure, and we are doing this cultural exchange of slave songs, of Mexican folk stylings, of indigenous hymns to create what country music is in Texas. And then before the Carter family, right, the first family of country music, had their break at the Bristol Sessions, you know, called the Big Bang of country music, the first country commercial recording was by Texas country musicians, right? So even before Nashville came in, country music was Texas and nature, right? So when Beyonce is saying, like, I am country, Texas is country, but our country looks different than what Nashville has intentionally marketed and distributed it is, because Texas is home to the progressive movement, which came out of the 60s around Austin being known as our liberal hub in Texas, right? You have the outlaw country music, which was a firm rebuke against everything Nashville was doing, that kind of country cosmopolitan that came out of Texas.
Don't cross him, don't boss him, he's wild in his sorrow, he's riding and hiding his pain.
Selena, queen of Tejano, Tejano music, is country that came out of Texas, right? UGK, Pimp C saying Southern hip hop is country rap tunes, that comes out of Texas. So for us in Texas, that means something to us, because it's not just, I think, what Nashville would assume to be as a genre to be marketed and promoted. It's our identity, right? Our family, we're ranchers, we're cowboys, we worked the land, we sung in the fields, we soiled the crops, we bled, we made this state what it is, we made country what it is, we lived and we died in the country. So when Beyonce is saying, I am country, throughout her discography, right? Because it didn't just come on Act Two. She has hinted at this. She's saying, throughout my whole entire life, throughout the integrity of my life, I have been country. And I think it's very telling that when Jessica Simpson, another Texas girl, came out in the 1990s, early 2000s, she was allowed to be country. She's allowed to be the white Southern Belle. She's allowed to be on the Dukes of Hazzard movie, right? And even though Beyonce was the cover girl for Texas Monthly, right, in a Willie Nelson style with the braids and the bandana, she was never allowed to step into that, because unfortunately, when you equate Black and country in the United States, the first thought is minstrel, is slavery, is banjo, of the people who didn't become intelligent through going up north or to the Midwest through the Great Migration, right? There is a bias towards Black people from the South, towards Black people in the country, right? And we saw that so much with the death of Ahmaud Arbery, with all of the Black Lives Matter organizing that happened out of the Southern United States. So to bring that full circle for her to say, no, I'm from Texas and I am country, it is a, if I could invoke this, a whistleblow to all of us who have grown up in the South, in the country, who are not white, who are Black, who are Mexican, who are indigenous. Also in Houston, I want to say Vietnamese American, right? Because the Houston rodeo shows us what country music can be, which is multicultural, which is multiracial. To put on your boots, to put on your hat, and let's go to work, because it's time for a reckoning, as Dr. Royster just said. And I think the reckoning is here, and I'm excited to see what it is going to do for those spaces that have held on to this white idea of country, because the myth is being undone each and every day.
In thinking about dismantling that myth and digging into this history, Francesca, can you tell us a little bit about, I mean, you both have gestured at this already, but a little bit about, when we say the roots of country music are largely linked to Black people, to slavery, to these traditions, what are we talking about exactly? Like, how, I mean, I know we can't get into like every granular detail. I wish we could talk for 5 hours, but we can't. But if you had to sort of talk about the most important elements of how country music comes into form, and particularly as it pertains to Black people, what would you highlight as the main factors in that origin story?
Well, I mean, definitely taking as my model Rhiannon Giddens and the kinds of histories she so powerfully evokes, like I would definitely think about the banjo as one of our ways of thinking about the history of country music kind of before country music was called country music, like really talking about the music of enslaved Black people that we used for our rituals, for our entertainment of one another, getting work done, and also entertaining the master. So, you know, thinking about this instrument as it was modeled on African forms, as it was created in the Caribbean, as well as, and like traveled to the US, and thinking about the ways that that music was so pervasive and so much a part of Southern identity that when blackface minstrelsy became a cultural and commercial form, these were the songs that came with it. And I think that the creative hand of Black musicians and songwriters and dancers and all the things that are part of the caricatured version of Black culture that we get in minstrelsy, all of that hand and that influence gets erased. But then, like, okay, so how do we get to the genre as we understand it? We get to it partly in this moment of discovery of the commercial possibilities of recorded sound. So thinking about the first record labels in the 1920s and 30s who were collecting and really trying to sell furniture, partly, you know, selling furniture by selling records in an organized way. And there was the first creation of these genres to sell the furniture and records, or the records that would help you sell the furniture. Mm. And that was the creation of hillbilly music, which later became country music, which was marketed to white audiences, which was presented as a white produced creative endeavor, and the myth of kind of mountain music as this pure form, Anglo-Saxon form, was kind of perpetuated through that marketing. And then the creation of race music, which became a catch-all for Black creativity and Black music, including the blues and kind of early proto R&B as well, string band music, some other international music as well. So in this marketing of the music is mirroring Jim Crow segregation. And this is like so many other kinds of commercial and cultural institutions, the ways that we experience music is shaped by this. And it also included an erasure of any kind of crossing in terms of Black artists who were teachers or who were performers on what was being presented as hillbilly music. And on the other hand, too, more or less the erasure of any white musicians who were part of race music's production, although it wasn't as carefully protected. So we get this kind of myth of the music that is eventually becomes country music in the 1950s as being really like naturally white, that this is the music that appeals to an audience. These are the bodies, these are the lives and stories that are part of this music. And it is an ideology, it is a myth that also is very much protective of ideas about cross-racial mingling or miscegenation, you know, fears of connections or organizing, you know, across racial lines. All of these things are shaping the way that we receive country music. And in turn, you know, especially as migration from South to North was happening for African Americans, but especially also for white migrants and the performance of, or the creation of a white identity, there's kind of this way that country music was a way to hold on to older ideas about the South. You know, the South will rise again. This is like the music. This is the soundtrack. This is where we can express our white pride. This is the way that we can protect an old way of life and hang on to it, and maybe also replicate it maybe in our social relations. So I think that there are like these key moments where country becomes the soundtrack for that kind of political organizing, you know, thinking about Fiddlin' John Carson early in the 1930s, like one of country music's first white stars, performed at KKK rallies.
You can count the days I'm gone on the train that I left on. You can hear the whistle blow 100 miles.
Or even thinking about the ways that country music has been embraced more recently as a kind of way of kind of nationalistic performance of whiteness by Nixon or by Bush or by others, even by Trump. So, you know, so we have this history where country music becomes a weapon for evoking a past and making America great again, let's say. Mm-hmm. Let's use that again.
Jason Aldean comes to mind in this moment as we're speaking.
Yeah, yes, for sure.
It's interesting. I mean, and in so many ways, this story is unfortunately not unique genre-wise in America. I mean, it reminds me so much of the story of early rock and roll music and the ways in which artists, obviously like Little Richard, were essentially erased, unable to support themselves through a lot of their lives, et cetera, while their songs were popularized by white-facing artists. And I think rock and roll suffers a similar situation where we now think of it as the white music. I mean, when we think about rock and roll now, and I actually, I have a lot of curiosity about whether Beyonce might take this one on next. I'm not sure, but it's interesting to think about it. And then again, you know, less, you know, I think hip hop has had a has been, I guess maybe because of the era that it came up in or various circumstances, has been able to hold on as a, you know, black facing genre for the most part. But also there were so many periods, like I just, in my, obviously in my own upbringing, where, you know, a lot of the most popular rappers like Eminem, and, you know, you see it obviously all the way through Jack Harlow and Iggy Azalea. And, you know, this is a tale as old as time, as we understand it. Are there particular black country artists from the mid-century, from the moment that the genre crystallized, that we just don't think of if you're a casual country fan and you only know kind of like Johnny Cash or whoever, like the main sort of white facing artists from this period, that feel just important in highlighting or important in terms of thinking about Cowboy Carter and like where Beyonce might be sort of positioning herself in a lineage of black female country artists? Are there particular godmothers of this space that you think she might be looking to in particular?
Definitely thinking about Linda Martell, who has been a godmother of country to many. And she's someone whose name we know in part because when she made Color Me Country in 1970, you know, she had some success. She charted, she performed at the Grand Ole Opry, she was on Hee Haw, all these ways that the Nashville establishment allowed in limited ways support of her career. But then that also was ultimately undercut and she was disinvested in. She's still alive. And as I understand, there's her story is in progress of being made into a documentary by her granddaughter. But I really think about her because she is someone who was able to infiltrate those spaces. And in terms of earlier performers, as I understand, the pattern of kind of being offered a chance, offered a contract, and then being disinvested in is one that has happened in earlier time periods as well. But, you know, some other artists to think about are, of course, Tina Turner, who had her turn in Tina Turner's Country On and in Nutbush City Limits. If it's all right. Ruby Falls, another kind of little known country music grandmother who had more regional success, but really didn't get a chance to develop a career because of health problems. She died, I think, of a brain aneurysm, I think. I almost lose my mind. When he loves me, he always loves me. And then thinking about like women who are still making music now, people like Frankie Staton or people who also kind of held things down with Black Country Music Association, which, you know, was a really important organization for supporting Black country music artists out of Nashville, but also larger. Nico Marx, eventually kind of thinking about the present day folks of like Rissy Palmer and eventually Mickey Guyton. But I think that there's more work to be done in terms of that older generation, previous generation, pre-1950s Black women. I mean, we know that Etta Baker and Elizabeth Cotton, as guitarist geniuses and banjo playing geniuses, were making music for their families like during that time and kind of had some limited recording success, but really didn't become household names, or, you know, at least in the folk world, household names in terms of progenitors of country music and bluegrass until they were in their 80s and 90s. And they were supported by people like Pete Seeger and Taj Mahal. But I feel like, to me, Elizabeth Cotton and Etta Baker are kind of the signs that there is a whole history still that we don't have yet, or that we don't know. Maybe it's not as out there of Black women making music. And these were also women who just made music in their everyday lives. Like Etta Baker used to sit in her garden and play, you know, at the end of a work day.
How good is this episode? It's good, right? Well, great news, because if you like what you're hearing here, you're going to love what we're doing over on our Patreon channel, Pop Pantheon All Access, where for $5 a month, you'll get bonus episodes of our show weekly. You heard that right. Every single week, we're dropping more of the same searing in-depth combos you love about all your most anticipated new albums by stars like Ariana Grande, Dua Lipa, and Tate McRae, just to name a few, parsing apart all the newest pop singles in our famous new music speed rounds. And of course, diving deep on your favorite classic albums like Madonna's Hard Candy, Christina Aguilera's Stripped, and so much more, all with your favorite Pop Pantheon guests. All this, plus you'll get access to our Discord channel, input on future episodes of the show, and so much more. So sign up at the icon tier now at patreon.com/poppantheon or simply by clicking the link in the show notes of this episode. You won't regret it. The erasure of the whole thing is in some ways what I'm hopeful that this Beyoncé project, and as we all attempt to parse the Beyoncé project again, it's like that sort of brilliance of who Beyoncé is as a figure is such a rich text, like just inherently, that I think she knows and has earned the distinction of like us picking apart everything that she does, and like that's what Beyoncé music begs, and it's just such a beautiful part of her existence in pop culture that like that's part of her pop music. Like how often do you have a pop star that's like on that level where the text is like this rich and this interesting, and like it's really incredible to watch her utilize that unique power that she has in this way, like almost to unearth like this feeling of almost like what will be launched out of this in some ways, and like obviously work that you both have been doing, and like bringing that like in the package of Texas Hold'em being like this incredibly joyous, fun pop song that everyone's now obsessed with. Like there's just so much to bring forward about this history, and like I mean so much of the story of, unfortunately and sadly, of Black people in this country is the idea of like erasure of broader popular culture, essentially trying to like torch that history literally and figuratively. And it's just like incredible to see the power that like a pop album could have in potentially like bringing forth some of that. Is just like why she's so unique. Like it's just she's such a moving figure in so many ways, but that's just one of the ways. Taylor, are there any other Black women that you would like to just highlight as sort of historically important, or do you think that might be informative to whatever this lesson that Beyoncé is about to give us in her own work that you feel like maybe people should know about?
You know, Beyoncé is such a child of Houston, and I want to ground it in Houston because the Black experience in Houston is inherently country, right? You have Prairie View A&M, which was an HBCU, which main tenet of education was agriculture, farming, and ranching, right? So in the city in which she was born, there has been this Black institution to create and produce the next generation of Black farmers and ranchers and cowhands. And the oldest Black Trail Ride Association is the Prairie View Trail Riders, right? Houston has been a chocolate capital, to invoke sociologist Zandria Robertson, a chocolate capital that is inherently country, that is inherently Western, right? We just had the Houston Rodeo, and I think it's the first time Vogue magazine covered it through a Black and Brown's lens, right? That is something that is so unique and nuanced. And I think we saw that a lot on Solange's When I Get Home album, where they're talking about this Black Texan experience through their identity, through the people who have come before them. And it's becoming this full circle moment that I think she could only have by sharing with her daughters. You know, I say that Act Two is such a Tina album because her mother, Tina Knowles, was born in Galveston, which is the birthplace of Juneteenth. And her mother has memories of not even being allowed to walk on the beach, right? And then you have this now where Beyoncé has, for the past 5 years, become a mother, has seen Blue Ivy take the stage with her on Renaissance, and it almost feels as if kind of what Dr. Roster said, this ritual, this passing down of something that even though her children are not being raised in Texas, right? I was born outside of Texas, but my mother, as soon as I could talk, brought me back home, right? There is also this, I want you to have this identity. I want you to have this collective memory. And I think for her to give this in a moment when her daughter is coming of age, like Beyoncé came of age in 16 carriages, for this to be happening where there's so many eyes on Texas as this Democratic figure of what the DNC should look like and how it should move and operate. This work is extending beyond just national and the country music industry, but I think it's kind of touching into this collective Black consciousness right now of what would it look like if the world's biggest ambassador for country music was a Black woman from the South, and how would it undo not only myths about the industry and the genre, but this nation and this state overall. So it's a beautiful time to see what this work is going to do. I think the title track or the first track is Deep South, and that is a term coded with a lot of racial and political and economic and racial conversations. So this work, I think, will not only change, I think, Nashville, but maybe Southern studies overall, which is an academic field of study that's still very white and very male. And she's telling you, no, Southern studies is Black and female and to an extent queer. And I think that's really, really impactful right now. Obviously, I feel like we haven't talked about Megan Thee Stallion in this, who also, if we're going to talk about country, that's someone we haven't brought into the conversations in Cowboy Counter, how the Stallion and the Year of the Stallion has also changed what we think about cowgirls in pop culture, and the fact those two are working together.
Yes.
Love that.
Like Beyonce, like me. He want a bitch like the Stallion with the knees. He be like, damn, how that thing moving in the jeans. Even D4L couldn't do it like me, like me.
That's such a good one. I mean, the other question I also wanted to ask is, we're dealing, and we talked about this a little bit, with the provocations of Beyoncé's simply announcing this record or announcing these singles, and how upsetting that has been to the gatekeepers in Nashville. I'm curious what that history looks like. Like, the history of Black pop artists in particular. Francesca, you brought up Tina Turner, obviously, as someone who's made this attempt before, but what has been the reception historically of even massive Black superstars like Tina Turner, like Ray Charles, who have taken a pivot into country? How has that been received in the various moments that it's happened? And is like that instructive to this moment for Beyonce in meaningful ways?
Oh yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, thinking about Tina's country music album, you know, the ways that that album could have been like, and, you know, might still be, but could have been much more of a sense of a kind of bridge, a way of thinking about Black participation as being much more continuous. It was actually nominated for a Grammy, though it didn't win. I think she was up against Roberta Flack. So, you know, hey, good luck with that too. But, you know, it's an out of print album. You can't stream it right now. You can, you know, go to YouTube at the moment and might be able to now. And thinking about Ray Charles too, you know, very much already an established R&B leader and icon when he made Modern Sounds and Country Music Volumes 1 and 2. That album also really, he had to struggle to get radio play for it way, way after the fact. That album has been recognized by institutions like the Country Music Hall of Fame and the Grand Ole Opry, but it took decades. And really the support and endorsement of white performers like Willie Nelson or others who really talked about how, I don't want to use the word seminal because, you know, patriarchy, but I'll just say like influential that album has been, and really modeling how to bring together multiple sounds, to bring together in an explicit way blues and rhythm and blues and country music in terms of mainstream country, and making that sound really the standard.
Since we've been apart, I can't stop loving you. I've made up my mind.
And then, you know, also thinking about a hugely successful person, Darius Rucker, also has had to struggle. Also, Pride, Charlie Pride, also had to deal with threats on their lives because of the music that they're making. Something that doesn't get talked about a lot, I think, but maybe will get talked about now, is really that to perform in this genre as an artist of color is also to put yourself in physical vulnerability. And, you know, in my own research, almost every artist that I've studied and written about has talked about that, you know, really feeling fear and feeling, and fans also feeling unsafe. So I think that we're in a moment where activists, folks have been making more spaces that are more welcoming cross-racially for lots of different folks and in terms of gender. And I really think about the work of Holly G and the Black Opry Review and the work of Rusi Palmer, kind of raising up different artists, Alison Russell's activism work, like really kind of working together to fight like major issues in Tennessee around healthcare for trans youth and around gun control. So these are artists who, despite this kind of vulnerability of their careers, but also their bodies, are using whatever platforms that they have to connect the issues of gatekeeping and the racism behind it to other issues that are also connected. And I think that's really what we need, is like a recognition that these are not just about radio play, but really about histories that are erased, histories of struggle, of present day lives that are also erased, and the political fabric of our lives.
What does it say about like the power that, or the vice grip that Nashville holds over this world, that artists as powerful as Tina Turner and Ray Charles and now Beyonce struggled to gain the capital to help destroy some of these barriers? Like, I mean, it's as an outsider to Nashville, as someone who's like not particularly like in that world and only knows it from sort of like a peripheral outside view, it's just striking to me because I think about the power that Beyonce holds in every other pop cultural space. I mean, look, not the Grammys. That's another interesting, I think, parallel to this. It's like, no matter how successful, how critically revered, how consistent, how monumental in nearly every conceivable way that popular music can be monumental, you know, Beyonce still cannot break through to that Album of the Year trophy at the Grammy. So obviously her power is not all consuming, or there's clearly a finiteness to it. But that aside, Beyonce is clearly one of the most powerful pop cultural figures to have ever existed. And, you know, same could be said for Tina Turner, obviously. And I guess, what does it say about how entrenched that Nashville establishment is that, like, basically that continues to just be, I don't want to say not enough because I don't want to, like, diminish the work, but it's just, it just feels sort of almost mind-boggling, like, how hard it is to break these walls down. And it's not even just for Black women, but for women in general. I mean, we're still in a situation where, like, of course, white women seem to have more of a place in the Nashville establishment, but still barely get any radio play, get pushed out to the fringes of the culture. Even someone like Kacey Musgraves, I was thinking about, you know, when Taylor, when you were talking about Texas, and, you know, she has a line on her new record that's like how about how much she loves Texas, but none of their laws. I just thought that was like an interesting little line. How can this still be so entrenched in this way, like in the world that we live in today? It just feels a little mind-boggling to me. I don't know if there's an answer to that question. I just wanted to throw it out there.
I mean, there is so much money, and really, like, Nashville is a brand, you know, it is a packaging of something that is a global enterprise. And the structures that are there are definitely reinforced, and, you know, it pays to this for the kinds of barriers to remain protected. And this is a brand that a lot of people are invested in protecting. And so it might be that particular spaces in Nashville proper, recording studios or places, you know, labels where songwriting happens or Music Row or other places might be diversifying, but there's still this idea, a homogenous kind of idea that's kind of sold and packaged that, you know, I even see in Chicago, because now there's like a country music tourism scene, believe it or not, in Chicago, you know, where there are bars and it's a very static representation of what country music is. So part of me is definitely just thinking about global capitalism and how it paid to protect those boundaries.
It's like a self-fulfilling prophecy. I mean, Taylor, I'd love it if you want to weigh in on this too, but I was just thinking as you were speaking, it's like a self-fulfilling prophecy because I just think for my own self, and again, you know, I'm, you know, in a different space than many people that are within Nashville and without Nashville, but I'm a music lover and I feel very like not welcomed because I don't see artists that are speaking to me directly because I don't like Jason Aldean. I don't really connect to like Morgan Wallen. And as someone who's just like a casual observer of country, like that's what I see. I don't see a lot of queer voices in the front, you know, and like name any other sort of like marginalized community or even women. I mean, like think about women's like every entree I've ever had to country is always, and anytime I've ever cared about country, it's always or most often been in the vessel of a woman, whether that be Mickey Guyton or it be Kacey Musgraves or it even be like Taylor Swift or whatever it is, you know. And it's like, and every time that I feel like I experience one of those people, they get pushed out of Nashville. Like Kacey gets pushed out of Nashville, Taylor Swift gets pushed out of Nashville, or they continue to sort of like be in the struggle to like gain the recognition of like the true icons of the space in any given moment. And to me, that always appears to be the Morgan Wallen or the Jason Aldean or Toby Keith or whoever, people that I just like do not connect connect to at all. So it becomes this thing where it's like, I don't become a Nashville country fan because Nashville doesn't allow artists to rise to the foreground that like would make me become a Nashville fan. So it becomes like a self-fulfilling prophecy where they're just feeding the same thing to the same people over and over again. And it creates a, like, no space for other people to enter. I don't know. That was just one thing I was thinking of. Taylor, is there anything you wanted to add about that?
No, Nashville becoming Nash Vegas in pop culture, I think is aligns to what Dr. Rostry is saying, because there's so much of an investment, right, in a continuation and a development of this singular thing, of this experience. This is what Nashville is to the world. This is what we are going to market it as, because we are making money out of it, right? There is no incentive for the powers that be to disinvest from something that is making them money, right? A city, which is a chocolate city, right? Nashville has HBCUs. Nashville has always had a percentage of residents that were middle class and upper middle class Black elite professionals, right? There are institutions and neighborhoods that have a rich Black cultural history that have contributed to the Black culture productions of America. But for the powers that be, it's not profitable to market that, right? It's not catchy. I can't get a bachelorette party with a party bus to go tour the HBCUs in Nashville and think about all of the Black student organizations that had gospel singers, and the gospel singers in Nashville not even being accepted by the Nashville elite because they say that Black country is gospel and gospel is not white country, right? Just the amount of hoops that Black people in Nashville have to jump through to even say, hey, like, I can do country music. I grew up here. And they're like, no, like, go to Atlanta. But even Black people from Atlanta are moving to Nashville and creating this music, right? So I think Nashville is in this crisis of identity because, yes, there are white conservatives moving in, but also there are Black people from other chocolate cities moving into Nashville, right? There are queer people moving to Nashville. There have been queer people in Nashville, right? There have been Black people in Nashville. So to kind of make it a full circle moment, I think the whole entire nation should be looking at this moment, because in the same week that Alison Russell won a Grammy, Brother Jones, who is a prominent Democratic politician in Nashville, he was almost thrown out of the Nashville House, and the Nashville GOP would not acknowledge Alison Russell. But in the same session, they acknowledged Paramore, and Hayley Williams of Paramore said, we will not take this recognition if you do not give it to Alison Russell. In that same time frame, neo-Nazis stormed down downtown Nashville after release of Texas Hold'em and 16 Carriages. So we're seeing an overt response and reaction to Beyonce doing country music. I have to think that there is some type of relationship between Beyonce releasing country music and neo-Nazis marching down on downtown Nashville and the Tennessee GOP trying to throw out a Black young Democratic politician. We should be looking at what the response is going to be by those who listen to country music as a whistleblow, as an indication to maybe insurrect someone or maybe cause a bloodbath, right? We should be looking at how those people who were so invested in this Nashville brand and this white identity respond to what she is going to do on March 29th, especially in an election year.
That's chilling, Taylor. And I just want to say, like, to me, even though I don't have any readings of it formed, it brings me back to the cover, you know, of Cowboy Carter, the weaponization, let's say, of, you know, national presidential portraiture, as well as Kehinde Wiley, his artwork reframing and appropriating those nationalistic kinds of images and putting Black bodies in them. So just thinking about sounding the alarm, you know, to quote a Beyonce song. Yeah, like, this is a really interesting, somewhat chilling moment, I have to say.
Yes, in so many ways, yeah. I mean, and Beyonce has been very powerful in her ability to provoke these conversations and to appear as a voice for a lot of this conversation through her work. I mean, I think about her in the Black Panther outfit on the Super Bowl field in, what was that, 2016 or 2017, like right after Trump was elected. She really utilizes her voice in incredibly impactful ways. Or even her drowning on the car in the Formation video in the middle of Louisiana. That was just such a, you know, she's incredible at creating images or like using her work to provoke and also like to give voice in these particular hot button issues, but in a way that somehow like turns them joyous. It's really incredible. All right. So I guess to sort of wrap us up here, there have been Black artists that have made inroads into country's establishment in recent times, from like Kame Brown to Mickey Guyton. I also know there was this moment with Rhiannon Giddens, who plays on Texas Hold'em, where like quotes were unearthed about her kind of like dissing Beyoncé's initial forays into country music, or sort of like expressing, I don't know, displeasure at her co-opting the idea of like being a Black woman in country as a pop superstar or as an R&B superstar. What has been the reaction amongst the sort of like Black elite of the country world to Beyoncé's foray into country overall, do you think? Taylor, maybe you want to grab that.
I'd be happy to literally take the reins and jump on the horse. You know, it is a... I got a cowboy boot. It has been a blessing and a curse, which I think is a euphemism for the Black experience in the United States, but I think in country, right? They are enthusiastic about the global recognition towards Black people in country. You know, Holly G is a friend of mine, and they have been able to break into international and foreign markets who talk about Black country music, and that has the potential for musicians to have tours over there to get a more expansive audience. I think that is the blessing of the whole entire world listening to Beyoncé, and in the world looking for Black people in country music who have always been doing this work and uplifting them, right? We've seen an increase in the streams. The curse is that there have been so many people for years, for generations, for decades who have been doing this work who have not received the quote unquote Beyoncé treatment. So now their call to action, right? Their calls to arm is to ensure that every Black person in country is treated like Beyoncé, that they get the attention, that they get the airplay, that they get the recognition, right? Not allowing this to literally be a moment of tokenization, or as I would like to call maybe the Black square in country music by mainstream overall, but making sure that this is something that is sustainable and long-term, because I think the ethos of this conversation is that Black people have been in country, right? And Black people will be in country if Beyoncé decides to go rock and roll for Act Three, which I believe she is. The Tina reference would make sense. And I think they're just wanting that moment to lead to not another moment, but to lead to a substantial change for all of them involved.
Yeah, I was just listening to an interview with Jake Blount on another podcast, and what he was talking about was the possibilities of genre queerness for him. You know, he's a Black country, more bluegrass and folk artist who's really both interested in the reclamation of old forms, older forms, visibility of current country music artists, and also kind of thinking about the future. And he really describes himself as Afrofuturistic. But I think one of his points that he was making in this interview from maybe a week ago was that once there is a chance to kind of talk about and make visible the history of Black creativity in the past and in the present, that it might free us up from some of the constraints and codes for him that are around genre, but in general, in terms of more creative freedom for folks to make the music that they want and to have multiple audiences. So I think that's an interesting way of thinking about one potential place we could go after, you know, after the Beyoncé moment, or what Beyoncé moment could make possible, or what we need to do maybe after the Beyoncé moment.
Maybe as like a final question, I guess, to jump off of that, like, what do you both hope is the long tail result of Cowboy Carter? Like, what would be the utopian outcome of whatever Beyoncé is attempting to do by placing herself in the country context so explicitly on this record? Like, if we look back, let's say 10 years from now at this moment as some sort of like incredible inflection point that forever altered our perceptions of country's white maleness as it's seen by the, you know, the most basic forms of pop culture at the moment. Like, what would you hope that this moment pertains for the future of country music moving forward, especially as it pertains to Black folks?
Well, I would love to see a Cowboy Carter syllabus, like where people are teaching classes and writing, you know, as an academic, really using this as a moment to dig into writing and teaching about this genre in a new way, and to think about this as an important part and entry into Black histories that aren't always talked about or that are sidelined. So that's one kind of my modest future hope.
So December marked 10 years of self-titled, right? So we have seen the whole entire music, digital media, digital age change since the release of self-titled. So 10 years from Cowboy Carter, I'm really hoping and praying that yes, this becomes something that the Academy preserves and documents and criticals and archive. But I'm also excited for the rumored Tejano aspect of this. There have been a rumored Zydeco songs that are going to be on here. And I think as like a music critic and writer, I love when a major artist like Beyonce, who pays respect, who does her research, right, who has the receipts, mm-hmm. takes her worldwide platform to put an awareness on like Tejano music, which really hasn't been mainstream in such a long time. You know, we've seen the rise of regional Mexican music on Billboard, but we haven't seen a pop star be Tejano since Selena. And Selena was a major influence on Beyonce, right? Mm-hmm. So I'm excited to see Cowboy Carter shed light on that history that often gets overlooked or maybe is excluded to only like the Latin Grammys, as well as Zydeco, which is this beautiful cultural production from Louisiana, from like East Texas. Like that is a Black trail ride culture, which is very nuanced and hidden and secretive. And if you have any type of family from East Texas, which also has an HBCU, and Louisiana, which has multiple HBCUs, that is your dance music. That is your party music. That is what you do on the weekends in the summertime with your family, with your country cousins. Like that feels so nuanced. And for that to be allegedly on the album, I think is going to change a lot of studies of music, of Black music, of Black contemporary music, and also acknowledging the stuff that we made in the swamps, in the field, in the marches that maybe always didn't go up where the trains went in the Great Migration. So I'm excited for us to do more appreciation and acknowledgement of these nuances of Black cultural Southern identity that we don't talk about a lot.
So, okay, I have a good one for us. Maybe Taylor, can you, as a last question, is there a Zydeco song or something that you could put our audience onto that we could send the podcast out on, like something that just feels emblematic to you if people are not familiar with the genre and what it sounds like that you would want to introduce people to?
Oh my God, you put me on the spot. I feel like I got asked my top five and I am just freaking out right now. I want to disassociate.
Do you want to take a moment and think about it?
Hot Tamale Baby, Buckwheat Zydeco, that word?
This is why you podcast with your sister, okay? They were sisters.
She came to your rescue. All right, so I just want to thank you both so, so much for being here. This was such an incredible conversation. I am so glad that we have an opportunity here to discuss some of these maybe more forgotten histories for many people. I really hope these conversations are going to continue, and I am so glad that Beyonce exists so that she can provide a forum for us to bring some of these conversations to people that probably would never have had them. And I just want to thank you both so much for all the work that you're doing on this and for agreeing to come and talk to me about it all. It was really incredible. You're both amazing. So Taylor Crumpton, Dr. Francesca Royster, thank you so, so much for being on the show.
I love you, sis. This was so beautiful.
Thank you. I really, really, I'm just beaming. I'm just like, so it's going to take me about to stop smiling.
I am too.
Yes. Thank you both so much.